Now on Radio 4, Saturday Night Theatre.
People like us sit on the sidelines and we watch the varying fortunes of the players. And something happens to connect us with the players. A ball within our reach, a smile across the grass, and we're involved. And there's no escaping that involvement. We're dragged in on the game, for better or worse.
Welcome These Pleasant Days by Michael Robson, with Nigel Anthony as Forgan, Ian Hogg as Dimmock, and Elizabeth Proud as Elaine.
You've done wonders with the place since I was last here. It really is. It's very attractive.
It suits me very well. And when I'm eventually called on to retire, I shall make no bones about settling down here permanently.
But retirement's a long way off, surely, in your line of work.
Well, 20 years, perhaps, but...
Isn't there something missing?
From where?
The dining room table. The silver.
Ah, yes, the silver.
It's at Oxford.
No, it was stolen from here. 7 pieces in all.
Stolen?
I realize the distress the child must have caused you, Dr. Forgan, and I'm extremely sorry. But if I can only begin to explain the circumstances that have brought her to this attitude of mind, I'm certain you'll find it in your heart to forgive her.
Stolen?
By a girl. A young woman called Elaine Birmingham.
Elaine Birmingham? No, means nothing to me. But you said it as though it should. What happened to her? Was she thrown into the slammer?
And what I think you'd better do is to pour us both drinks and I'll tell you the story, in however fragmentary a fashion, of Elaine Birmingham and her parents, Angela and Wilfred.
Oh, come on. This is an insane parody.
Not to 5 million homes in Britain. Neville, to the drab, the dark and the neglected, Wilfred Birmingham delivered a riot of primary colours. I once saw the results in a housing estate in Belper. Broad looms by Birmingham irradiated their lives. Now, I was told on good authority that vandalism had virtually disappeared from the estate following the advent of Wilfred's rainbow carpeting. And it must have been around then that the girl was born.
So, it's a lass, huh?
Are you disappointed, Wilfred?
Nay, girl. Whatever you do's all right with me. Plenty of time for a son and herb, and you've got your health and strength back after this young'un.
Having babies really pulled me down. I feel that poorly.
A pint of milk stouted ale, put the roses back in your cheeks, Angela. You'll be right as rain in no doubt. Any road. What we're going to call it?
it?
The lass. I've a fancy for Geraldine, myself.
Geraldine?
Aye, after me gran.
Who had the baby, Wilfred?
Who? It's only a suggestion, like. Worth thinking over.
There's no need to think nothing over. My mind's made up.
Oh,
I shall call her Elaine. Just like that.
Elaine? Why, Elaine, love?
Because it's a name you can't shorten.
You what?
You get Wilf, I get Ange. I can't abide Ange and you hate Wilf, but what do we get? Wilf and Ange. Well, this time it's going to be different. That baby gets Elaine. And nothing else, or I'll know the reason why.
It could get Ellie.
If anyone dares call that lass Ellie, they'll never darken my door again. So think on.
I was right. This is parody. No one has actually talked like that in our lifetime. It's pure invention on your part.
Well, how on earth can you know how people talk in Halifax when the furthest north you've been is Gerard's Cross? Anyway, it amuses me to assume that's how Wilfred and Angela Birmingham conducted themselves at critical moments.
All right, all right. But it's the missing silver I'm interested in. When do we get to that?
Ah, by way of one Dennis Ludlam, a nearish neighbour of mine. He was the first visitor I ever had here, and that was an age ago. Ah, yes, the purple orchises have since put by the coronals of that forgotten summer.
What?
It was mid-August, and almost impossibly hot. The grass had grown jungle high, and I was trying to cut it back with a sickle. I was aching and sweaty and enjoying it all immensely because it made such a change from my rooms in college. Anyway, above the grass and over the hedge, I caught sight of an energetic cyclist fairly racing up the hill towards me. The man was very brown, short and stocky. He wore a snug beret and modish little breeches and stockings. Clearly a cycling adept.
Dr. Morgan?
Yes?
Good afternoon to you. My name's Ludlam. Live down the road there. Heard you just moved in and wondered if there was anything we could do.
Why don't you come inside? Come into the kitchen. It's the coolest place at the moment, and I could do with a beer. I imagine you could too.
Going to be a weekender or a permanency?
Well, to be truthful, neither. Yeah, I teach at Oxford, and that gives me rather more than half the year to live where I like. And I shall spend the bulk of it here.
Good. And you couldn't have picked a more beautiful part of England.
Indeed not. You lived here long yourself?
All my life, and my father before me.
But, you aren't a farmer?
No, solicitor. Family business in Shaftesbury, 3 miles away. No distance. Except in snow, I cycle there every day. And back, of course.
Of course.
You're the second newcomer to the area in a week. Oh, I've never known such excitement.
Oh, really?
Yes. The Birminghams have bought a massive place near Semley. Semley Grange, it used to be called. And will be again, I imagine, once they've settled in.
The Birminghams?
The carpet people. Broad looms by Birmingham, those Birminghams.
Ah. Weekenders or permanencies?
Oh, more the latter than the former, I should guess. At least on the distaff side. Mrs. Birmingham enjoys poor health. And it appears to be her belief that she can recruit better in Wiltshire than in central London. Not an assumption I'd quarrel with.
Mrs. Birmingham must be very forthcoming, given they've only been here a matter of days.
Informative. Well, do you see, I have an inside ear, as it were. The Birmingham daughter, Elaine, is a particular school chum of my daughter, Nairne.
Ah.
Over the past 2 years, Elaine spent several holidays with us, and at Easter, we had a visit from her father.
You've been very good to our Elaine, and I'm really grateful to you both.
We enjoy having her here, Mr. Birmingham. She's a sweet girl, and she's excellent company for Naomi. They get on so well together, and they like the same things.
Exactly. Ponies. Pony mad the pair of them. I couldn't be more delighted. And now I've had a chance to see for myself what it's like round here. I've made my mind up. I shall buy. I've talked it over with Mrs. Birmingham and agreed. We'll buy you. So, what would you advise? What I'm after is a short list of property that's already been vetted, so I can come up and see a number of likely places over one weekend. You've lived here all your life, Mr. Ludlam, and you must know the snags and advantages of anything that's up to much. I'd like your help, and I'll see you're not out of pocket on account of it.
We should be glad to help, but there can be no question of money.
House hunting takes time, Mr. Ludlam, and in my book, time's money.
Of course we'll help you, Mr. Birmingham. But What kind of property did you have in mind?
Something substantial. With land, of course, and stabling.
Oh, yes, quite. And how much land were you thinking of?
Oh, 100 acres, thereabouts.
That's what he wanted, and that's what he got. An idea at Easter, a reality by August. Mr. Birmingham doesn't let the grass grow under his feet.
Well, he does sound formidably energetic.
But most agreeable. Oh, I've no doubt that the local gentry will patronize him for all they're worth, laugh at him behind his back, and goad him cap in hand for donations to every facetious charity under the sun. But he's a far better man than most of them.
Well, I can see he's greatly impressed you.
Hmm? Oh. Well, at any rate, he's got the mansion he wanted. And my daughter and his are in the saddle every day exploring his domain. You know, I've quite forgotten what I came here for.
Sizing up the newcomer and seeing if there's anything you can do.
Oh, Lord, yes, of course. Look here. My wife's made a list of the principal tradesmen, their addresses, telephone numbers, reliability or otherwise. I think it's pretty thorough.
This is very thoughtful of you both. Thank you.
Well, it may be of some use. I better be going, I suppose. Oh, incidentally, Dr. Forgan, do you play billiards?
Billiards? Billiards, I promise you. It appears that the one thing left to the Ludlams when the cyclist's raffish and intemperate old grandfather died was a full-sized billiard table. And the solicitor can't bear to part with it, although Mrs. Ludlam constantly complains of its vastness and unsuitability in a modest dower house.
Well, it's an interesting little news item. But what bearing does it have on the theft of your silver?
It has every bearing. Because that grandiose billiard table became my entree to the Ludlam household, and thence to Elaine Birmingham.
Ah, the plot thickens.
About a fortnight after his first visit here, Dennis Ludlam cycled over from the dower house with an invitation to dinner.
Nothing formal, you understand. A modest collation with perhaps a game of billiards afterwards.
Mr. Forgan, your glass is empty. Dennis, would you...
Oh, my dear chap, do forgive me. Half and half, isn't it?
Thank you. You have an enchanting house, Mrs. Ludlam.
Well, we're very fond of it, of course. Although I'm afraid it has grown rather shabby. We had to make a choice quite early on as to whether to neglect the children's education and completely refurnish the house, or do our best for the young ones and let the house go hang.
Children, I hadn't realized there was more than one. I've heard about your daughter.
Oh, Nairn is the baby of the family. Victor's at the university, and Edward's with his regiment in Southern Arabia.
Ah, yes. I can quite see. 3 years a lot to educate if you do it the hard way.
Yeah.
Ah, thank you.
But it's worth it in the end, don't you think? Private education prepares them so much better for life, doesn't it? You only have to look at Elaine Birmingham. To meet her, the archetypal public schoolgirl. Poised, good company, and with such pretty manners. Quite capable of holding up her head in any society. If you were to meet her father...
There's nothing wrong with Wilfred Birmingham, Kate. He's a fine man.
Oh, surely. Worth his weight in gold.
The salt of the earth?
Exactly. And he had the nous to realize that if Elaine were fully to benefit from his wealth, some of it could best be spent on securing for her a good education. I've no doubt at all that in a few years' time, with her looks and poise and money, she'll be able to make a brilliant marriage.
And there she is. Elaine, we're in here.
Oh, hello. Come in, my dear, and meet another new neighbour. Elaine, this is Dr. Forgan, who teaches at the university. And this is Elaine Birmingham, Dr. Forgan.
How do you do?
Naomi, not with you.
Actually, no. She and Daddy are still trying to get the fountain to work. They've been at it all day, and they're absolutely filthy.
Oh, not too filthy, I hope.
Anyway, Naomi says she's forgotten her Sunday knickers and her Portsmouth dress. Do you know what she's talking about?
You haven't walked all the way from the Grange because Naomi's been forgetful.
No, Myers drove me over. I say, do you think I could beg a drink of something? I'm really dry, and it's been so hot and dusty.
Of course, darling. What would you like?
Actually, I'd love a shandy.
Of course you shall have a shandy. I'll go and make it up. Will you forgive us, Dr. Forgan, while Kate sorts out Naomi's coping deficiency?
Shan't be long.
Are you liking it here?
It's super. I mean, our house is rather weird. Nothing as nice as this, but it's tons bigger. But the grounds are super. Do you know it, the Grange at Semley?
No, I don't. This is the first time for a fortnight that I've set foot outside my cottage.
Ah. One big fault about the Grange, it isn't really old enough to have a ghost. Is your cottage haunted, Dr. Morgan?
I don't believe it is, Miss Sheffield.
Birmingham, actually.
Forgan, actually.
Forgan, I'm sorry. Isn't that an unusual name?
Not in Ireland.
Gosh, are you Irish? You don't sound it.
And you don't sound Yorkshire.
I think I'll have to be rather careful what I say to you in future.
Oh, I'd rather you weren't. I can always correct you.
Oh, of course. You teach at Oxford.
Yes.
What do you teach?
Ancient Greek.
Wow. Do you enjoy it?
Most of the time.
I don't suppose I shall ever learn Greek. Latin's quite enough for me, and I shall drop that as soon as I can.
Well, I shouldn't let it worry you. A world full of Greek scholars would be very heavy going.
I suppose it would, yes.
Your shandy, young lady.
It looks super.
So, that was your first encounter with her?
It was. By no means noteworthy in itself, and significant only in that it was the beginning of our somewhat fugitive relationship.
Was she likable?
It's disappointing to reveal that she made virtually no impression on me at all that first time. A pretty child with a pleasant voice and dirty denims. A lot of self-confidence. That was that. She was, at that time, an irrelevance to my life.
So how did she come to pinch your silver?
Ah, now, to understand that, you have to understand the nature of country society. Over Christmas of that year, I was having lunch in the local, and I fell in with one Nicholas Midwinter.
I don't believe it.
An Anglo-Arab stud near here. He knew all about me, of course, and discovered that I enjoyed riding. The upshot was that he had a mare who needed exercising, and I was free to take her out whenever I wished. And in this manner, I made the acquaintance of Windrush Hyperia.
Who?
She was a delightful animal. Plucky, affectionate, and full of fun.
Yes, yes, but what about the main plot?
In what I've been telling you, there's nothing irrelevant. One morning, I tacked up Windrush Hyperia, and we rode out. My objective was Windgreen Hill. You've been there with me. A slow approach one way, and a very heady drop another. And 900 feet above sea level. Trouble was, the higher we rode, the foggier it became. Until by the time we reached the top, you could hardly see 5 yards about you. There was a cold wind which buffeted the fog around, and Hyperia was nervous and anxious to be on the gallop, which would have been crazy in those conditions. But someone on Wind Green was crazy that morning.
What the hell is going on?
Get out of the way!
Rein in that horse! Control it! Right! Turn right, for God's sake! Just what the devil do you think you were playing?
We must go! That's what this place is for!
Not in conditions like these!
I didn't think anyone else would be up here today.
You simply didn't think! You realize you could have killed us? And the horses riding in a lunatic way like that? We could all have gone down the side.
Would it have mattered?
What you do with your life is your concern.
Yes.
You also chose to involve 2 innocent horses and me. I don't want my neck broken by the antics of an ill-natured adolescent.
Have you finished?
No, I have not. Is that your horse?
No. Yes.
So it's not. And you might have killed it. Who does it belong to?
What's it got to do with you? I didn't steal
him. Wait a minute. I know you. A friend of the Ludlam girl. Birmingham. Elaine Birmingham.
No, I'm not.
Young lady. I met you in London over 2 years ago. You just moved into the Grange at Semley.
Then you have a better memory than I have. Because I've never seen you before. Now, can I go?
Certainly. But I'm coming with you.
You're what?
I realize the distress the child must have caused you, Dr. Forgan. But if I can only begin to explain to you the circumstances that have brought her to this attitude of mind, I'm certain you'll find it in your heart to forgive her.
Oh, Dennis, Dr. Forgan must be well aware of what's happened to the Birminghams. He reads the newspapers, he listens to the wireless.
Well, I've just come back from a few weeks in Cyprus, Mrs. Ludlam. And a long way behind on local news. What has happened to the Birminghams? The parents divorced?
Divorced?
I'm afraid to say they're dead.
Dead?
Dead.
Both of them?
Yes.
An accident?
Well,
Mr. Birmingham was thrown through the plate glass window of his London office. He fell 4 stories onto the pavement in Victoria Street. He died in the ambulance.
Mrs. Birmingham died a month later of shock and grief, and of the heart disease that's troubled her for many years.
Well, if anyone else had told me this, So Mr. Birmingham was murdered?
Manslaughter, it's thought.
Oh, it's grotesque.
I think it's likely that the alleged felon, a Mr. Rufus Osgarthorpe of Leeds, will receive the lightest possible sentence.
Rufus Osgarthorpe of Leeds? I'm sorry. But the whole thing, why would Rufus Osgarthorpe wish to defenestrate Wilfred Birmingham?
Because he was owed £250,000. And because the morning the defenestration occurred, he just learned that there was no likelihood of his ever receiving it. He remonstrated with Mr. Birmingham so passionately that the unfortunate man was shoved through the window.
£250,000?
I'm afraid our poor neighbour died, leaving debts in excess of £4.5 million.
This is staggering.
As you can imagine. Because we know Elaine so well and came to know Mr. and Mrs. Birmingham fairly well once they bought the Grange, we felt it our duty to keep up with the increasingly alarming news that this year brought.
Looking back, it's clear that when he bought that remarkable house at Semley, he was living not merely on borrowed time, but on borrowed money.
He was a confidence man.
Certainly not. A man more sinned against than sinning. He was, in broad loom terms, a visionary, but no accountant. By the time he realized the magnitude of his debts, it was too late. The collapse of his empire was inevitable.
We've seen it before, Dr. Forgan. One thinks of John Bloom and his washing machines, of Dr. Savundra and his insurance company, and we shall see it again.
It was the advent of commercial television that ruined him. Until then, it had no serious competitors. His name and his product had been imprinted on the minds of his public for well over a decade. Then came the rivals and the commercials, and Birmingham found his methods obsolete. What he'd done so well, others could do cheaper and faster. So he decided, too late, to modernize his factories. He spent millions on new equipment, new premises, new warehouses, on retraining his personnel. Then he launched the single most costly television campaign ever seen in Britain. But it was too late. Broad Loom by Birmingham suddenly became in the public eye as old hat as dried eggs. He failed, and the creditors stormed him. Amongst them, Mr. Rufus Osgarthorpe.
But can you imagine the shock and horror that must have invaded Angela and Elaine? Two people entirely naive in commercial matters, given over in a moment to the hands of their objectionable London solicitor.
The truth of the matter is that your husband was his own worst enemy, Mrs. Birmingham.
Whatever do you mean?
He was proud, and rightly, of all he'd built up. But he was too proud to turn it into a limited liability.
I don't know what you're talking about, Mr. Kemp.
He used to say that he'd never dodge the column if his business failed. Everything he had would be at the disposal of his creditors. Everything, Mrs. Birmingham.
But from what I've read, Wilf left nothing for his creditors.
He left a fully furnished house in Wiltshire, Mrs. Birmingham. He left 3 motor cars, 4 ponies and a horse. He left a fully furnished house in London. This house, Mrs. Birmingham...
Of course he did. He left it to me.
The moment his business went into liquidation, the official receiver took over his affairs. Mr. Birmingham could not leave you what he no longer owned. It'll all have to go, I'm afraid.
Oh, but...
The houses, the cars, the animals, the land, the furnishings, and all his clothing and personal possessions.
Go where?
Do you realise how many people have been ruined by your father's downfall, young lady? Do you begin to understand how much he owes?
Oh.
Optimistically, the sale of all his possessions may bring in $500,000.
Will it really?
And that still leaves $4 million outstanding. £4 million that can never be repaid.
You mean... they're going to sell the roof over our heads, but where are me and Elaine to live? What are we to live on? I'm an invalid, Mr. Kemp. Elaine's a schoolgirl. How are we going to live?
I hope you have some understanding relatives. Otherwise, you'll have to ask the state to help you out.
Oh, the state. I could have killed him, Mr. Ludlam. That awful, common little man. I don't know how much money his horrible firm had from Daddy, but he treated my mother and me as though we were criminals.
How is your mother?
She isn't well. She had no idea things were as bad as this.
But she's being looked after.
By the state. She's in Charing Cross Hospital. They specialise in heart diseases, so they say.
But who's looking after you?
My Aunt Daphne, Father's sister. She's helping to organise the sale of the furniture.
This is a dreadful business for you, Elaine. Awful.
And what about school?
Oh, you can forget school. That's all finished.
But I'm sure Miss Vereker would sympathize.
She could hardly do anything else. Daddy bought the school a new gym and a swimming pool. But I expect Miss Vereker's thinking it was with dirty money.
I'm sure she thinks nothing of the sort.
Anyhow, how could I go back now? With everyone knowing what's happened, all the gossip and the giggling, all the nasty remarks.
But what's the alternative?
I can get a job, can't I? I'm 16.
Dennis did everything he could, Dr. Forgan. He tried and he pleaded.
She was very upset at the
time. He tried and he pleaded. He urged her to go back to school. He said she could spend her holidays with us. Naomi would never let her down. Miss Vereker was all consideration, but no, her mind was made up.
You can hardly blame her, Kate. It wasn't an intolerable situation.
Hey, what did she do?
Matters came to a head when poor Mrs. Birmingham died.
Oh, what a catalogue of horrors for the poor girl.
A gruesome catalogue indeed.
The house in London was the first to go. And Elaine went to live in Barnes with her Aunt Daphne.
Wilfred Birmingham's sister.
Mr. Birmingham's older sister. The younger lives in Tasmania, I believe.
I see. Barnes. And did she get a job?
Dr. Forgan, that girl has gone from misfortune to misfortune.
We tried to keep in touch with her.
Naomi wrote to her regularly from school. But after one perfunctory letter from Elaine, she heard nothing.
Then, what is she doing here?
It's been
there
most
are matters which I feel should be left to Elaine to recount, or not, as only she can decide, Dr. Forgan.
2 days after the incident with the horses, Elaine turned up here, looking both sly and exhausted. How long will you be staying with the Ludlams?
I haven't a clue. Well, I suppose until I find a job.
And down here? Wouldn't there be more openings in London?
I don't want to see London again as long as I live. The problems I had there.
I gather that after the misfortune, you went to live with your aunt in Barnes.
My aunt. You won't know what it's like to feel obliged to someone you can't stand. Oh, Barnes was all right. But to be cooped up in the house of someone who has you on sufferance, as a duty.
Your father's sister?
Daphne's the renegade of the Birmingham family. She's academic. She has a degree and a social conscience. She's principal of a teacher's training college, and I can imagine how she trains her teachers.
You don't get along with her.
She's like something beastly out of Dickens. No humour, no kindness.
You've had a very bad time of it recently, Elaine, and there's no one sorrier than I am about the way things have turned out. And it's decent and natural that you should grieve for your parents. I was fond enough of Wilfred myself, though we went our different ways in the world. But what's done's done. You've lost your parents, and you've lost a very nice way of life. A way of life very few girls of your age could ever have hoped for. But it's time to turn your back on all that and set about making your own way. You've several advantages. You've a good education behind you. You know how to behave in society. And when you take the trouble, you can be a very pretty girl indeed. All in all, not a bad start in life. I had a great deal less to build on. I was plain. I was poor. And in those days, and in our family, girls weren't encouraged to go in for higher education. The best I could expect was head of a counter at Marks and Spencer's in Halifax. But I dug my toes in. I stayed on at school and I took my high certificate in a county bursary and I was admitted to the University of Leeds. Proudest day of my life. Now, if you'd dug your toes in and swallowed your pride, you could be back at that very good school of yours now. Miss Vereker wanted you back. She welcomed you back, and there you could be.
Let's not go into that all over again.
And there you are, you see, looking the gift horse in the mouth. It's pride, you see. It's pride that was your father's downfall because he wouldn't make adequate provisions for his family. And it's pride that's cut you off from the benefits of a sixth form education.
Would you have gone back as a pauper?
When you get above yourself, it's time to take stock. I'm not altogether disappointed you're not going back there, because a school like that contains a lot of flighty girls who aren't a bit interested in higher education. They'll never need do a hand's turn in their lives because they'll be protected all their lives by money. But, Elaine, character isn't built on money. It's built on your own efforts.
What effort am I supposed to make?
It's your duty. It's your necessity to make yourself useful in life. And, fortunately, I have contacts who can help in that direction. I have a friend, Miss Gutteridge, who's doing very nicely with a useful little business in Richmond. She runs a commercial college where clever young people like you can learn shorthand and typing and business accountancy. 2 years with Miss Gutteridge, and you'll be well qualified to hold down a very good secretarial job anywhere in London.
Hip, hip, hooray.
Are you being facetious, Elaine?
A secretarial job wasn't what I had in mind.
I dare say it wasn't. But you're in no position to pick and choose, are you? You can thank your lucky stars that Miss Gutteridge is prepared to help out. She is offering you a 2-year course on very reduced terms, simply because I've been able to find places in my college for one or two of her best girls.
She must be a very wonderful person.
I don't admire your attitude, Elaine. Sarcasm's an unpleasant trait at the best of times, and it certainly doesn't become a bit of a girl like you. With regard to your predicament, with regard to what's actually the notoriety of Wilfred's death, we agreed it would be best if you didn't use your own surname at the college. If the other girls knew who you were, they could make life rather difficult for you. So you're enrolled as Elaine Hopper.
Elaine Hopper?
Your mother's maiden name. We've no need to be entirely fictitious.
Yes, I can see. Not the best of springboards for a glittering career.
It was awful, awful. I was sent up for putting on airs and graces. And when I managed to do well in the end-of-term exams, the other girls said it was because I had an in with Miss Gutteridge. Oh, I couldn't stand them. They were dreadful. So boring.
You'd win no popularity prizes in that society.
I was so fed up with their stupid chatter that I couldn't bear to eat where they ate. I made sandwiches for myself most mornings. But once a week I'd escape to a pub in Richmond. Any pub, just to get away from them.
Though you were underage?
Oh, that's why I enjoyed it. It was... I was defying all the precepts laid down by Aunt Daphne.
But is there any other significance in this pubbing of yours?
Are you catechizing me, Dr. Forgan? Yes, it was significant. I was in this pub one lunchtime. It was Friday and the place was packed. I'd found a corner stool and I was guarding my ham roll and my gin and tonic for all I was worth. And this man stood near me, trying to buy a drink. He was rather good looking. Fair hair, a thin, interesting face, and a fair moustache. He was wearing some unusual club blazer, and he knocked over my gin and tonic.
It doesn't matter.
Of course it matters. Your glass was full, and I, like a BF, knocked it over. What was it?
No, really.
Nonsense. Looked like a G&T. Sean, a large gin and tonic for the lady, and a large vodka and tonic for yours truly. So, though I say it myself, do you come here often?
Now and again.
Then why is it that I've never clapped eyes on you before, and I come here every day other than Sunday? Ah, have your glass replenished and with Malto apologies.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Cheers.
So, what's a beautiful creature like you doing in a hellhole like this?
I was having lunch.
Lunch? One of Sean's disgusting rolls?
Yes.
You should be feasting on stone crab and pink champagne.
Oh, if I had the money.
There's always money out for sensational girls like you. And I should know. I photograph them every day, except Sunday.
You're a photographer?
My card. I yield you my card. If only because you're the best thing that's swum into my ken since Sophia Loren.
Clifford Arundel. And you photographed her.
The proof positive, my angel. What about that?
It's beautiful. Where was it taken?
My studio. Not a stone's throw from here. Now, I know you must have had propositions from 100 guys at least. I really do believe you've got what it takes.
What takes?
Come on, fess up. You're a model, aren't you? I'm certain I've seen you in Vanity Fair.
Then you're wrong. I'm still studying.
The wrong things, darling. Your face, your figure, you should be on the front page of every glossy on the newsstand.
He couldn't have picked me up at a time when I was more ready to be picked up. He had charm and self-assurance, and he was an older man.
And his name again?
His card said Clifford Arundel, society and fashion photographer.
And was he?
Well, he had a Hasselblad with all the fittings, and he must have used two rolls photographing me in Richmond Park. Deer in the foreground, deer in the background, against a string of horses from Stag Lodge, running into Spankers Hill Wood. It took the best part of the afternoon, and Cliff was so helpful and enthusiastic. He was such fun.
The best part of the afternoon? Had you no lessons?
I skipped them. This was far more amusing.
And did you see the results of the afternoon's fun?
We were too busy. Afterwards, Cliff drove me to his studio. It was much smaller than I'd imagined and not a bit glamorous. It was over an ironmonger's shop. Quite honestly, it was tatty. Am I supposed to go on?
Up to you.
He introduced me to a girl called Murray and a boy called Ken, said they were his assistants. Then Cliff got me very drunk, and when I passed out, they undressed me and took pornographic pictures. When I realized what was happening, I nearly went mad. I knocked over one of his big lamps. It exploded. Everyone was yelling and struggling. Somehow I got dressed and just ran.
I'm afraid she doesn't want to see you at the moment, Miss Birmingham.
I dare say she doesn't. But I want to see her.
If you have Elaine's interests at heart, and I'm sure you do, then your best advice is to postpone the visit until she's ready for it.
What on earth did the girl think she was doing? Behaving so irresponsibly.
What time did she come home yesterday?
Oh, I can't be sure. She wasn't here when I arrived shortly after six. No note, no explanation, but that was hardly surprising. She often decided to go to the cinema or just out of an evening without telling me. But when she wasn't home by 11, half past 11, I became very worried indeed. At midnight, I rang the police. They told me not to worry unduly and that they'd make inquiries. I telephoned them again, twice. And at 3 this morning, they were on my doorstep. A girl answering my description of Elaine was in the general hospital. Would I go there and see if she was Elaine? I was terrified. I went with them, of course, and I identified Elaine. She hadn't recovered full consciousness when they administered the stomach pump, and she was sleeping heavily when I arrived. They told me there was no purpose to be served by my staying there, and that I should be notified when I could visit. And now you tell me I must wait for Elaine to make up her mind when she'll see me? Well, the whole thing's monstrous.
Hello. How are you feeling, love?
A bit better, thank you. Not much, though. Who found me?
A courting couple. You gave them a terrible fright. They thought you'd been murdered. You also made things difficult. They knew they had to get you to hospital as quick as possible. But unfortunately, he was married and she wasn't.
Oh, Lord.
The girl made the 999 call anonymously and then shot off home, presumably. The man stood by to look after you. You were wearing his jacket when the ambulance arrived. He wouldn't give his name, but the police detained him. They thought he must have something to do with your condition.
How awful.
Yes, wasn't it? They allowed him to telephone his wife. Heaven knows what excuses the poor man made. But if his marriage was dicey before, I reckon it'll be all washed up by now. Because until you'd come to, failed to recognise the man and got him off the hook, he was kept in custody.
He'd have been better off leaving me.
If he had, you and I wouldn't be sat here chatting. He saved your life and more than likely ruined his own to do it.
Well, can't I explain to his wife?
You keep right out of it. He's in enough trouble as it is.
It was Cliff's fault all this started. What about him?
The police were round at his studio first thing this morning. Everything gone, packed up clean as a whistle and away,
but
leaving quite a lot of rental outstanding.
But can't they trace him? Clifford Arundel. He showed me his card.
People who take pornographic photographs don't use their real name, love.
I think I'm going to be sick again.
You're going to be all right. What did you take?
I shall be sick if you make me talk about it.
Lots of aspirin in your auntie's cooking, Sherry. Yuck.
If you know Why did you ask?
The sicker you feel at the mention of aspirin and alcohol, the less likely you are to try them again. When are you going to see your aunt?
Never. I couldn't bear the thought of all those recriminations.
She means well. She has a nice house, and you've a pretty room of your own there.
It's a prison.
I've tried with that girl, Miss Peel. I've tried for 18 months. But she's sullen, incommunicative, and sometimes downright cheeky. If it wasn't for her unfortunate background, I'd have had her out of my house months ago. Well, she's had a nasty time, but she's done nothing to help herself. And she's shown me no consideration or affection.
She doesn't want to live here, Miss Birmingham.
Then what's to become of her? Well, she's not 18 yet. She's still a minor at law.
She'll have to stay in a hostel. There is a place for girls in a similar predicament in Richmond.
A hostel? Among girls with criminal tendencies?
A girl with criminal tendencies. Is that how you see your niece, Miss Birmingham?
Miss Peel was all right. I could get on with her. She was kind, but she was tough and practical. No sentimentality.
Well, that's her job. She's a welfare officer, and you're not related to her. You've given your aunt a rough time, haven't you?
Well, she deserved it, all that pity and piety.
So you chose the hostel?
Without Aunt Daphne, there was no alternative. I was in care and protection.
I can't imagine the hostel was an improvement on your aunt's home.
I swapped one kind of hell for another. Though there isn't much to choose between a domestic hell and an institutionalized one. I stuck it for a month, and I had all the snide remarks over again. What's an upper-class kid doing here? Slamming it, are we? Why weren't you devil of the year, then?
You haven't given it much of a whirl, have you? A month?
It's horrible. You must know how horrible it is.
You'll be 18 in 2 months' time. In 3 months, if you work, you'll have your secretarial qualifications. Then you can get a job, and we can find you some decent digs. A little flat later on, somewhere of your own once you've saved a bit. Is that asking too much?
What a smashing future. Digs in Twickenham and a job in a ball-bearing factory.
You could be pushing up daisies.
It'd be better than this.
I don't need self-pity, not in this office.
Look, I've had everything and you've never had anything, and that's the difference between us. And that's why you'll never understand that I'd rather be dead than have this nothing life.
Oh, there you are. I've put a sweat rug on Temeraire, but he needs a short feed after all that exercise. Would you be a poppet?
Yes, all right.
2 scoops of nuts and 1 of bran.
With a little water mixed in, mm-hmm. Yes.
And Dennis!
Coming, my love.
Dennis, don't you think the least we can do is to offer Dr. Forgan a drink after all this excitement?
Yes, of course. It's a...
Whiskey and water. Thank you.
And Dennis, the door, please.
Oh.
So, was she forthcoming?
Very. She'd reached the stage of threatening to quit the hostel. I can't wait for the next installment.
Oh.
I don't mean to be flippant, but that girl's packed more incident into just 2 years of her life than I've seen in 40.
Got enough water?
Oh, thank you.
She's had a ghastly time. An impossible time.
Mm. The greatest infortune.
What's that, old chap?
Oh, something Elaine said she said to the welfare officer reminded me of Chaucer.
Miss Peel reminded you of Chaucer?
Oh, Dennis, really?
Well, Chaucer wrote that the worst sort of human misery occurs when someone who's had everything looks back on the fool days of old, when they're down and out.
Exactly. Exactly. It's what I've said to Dennis over and over again. Elaine had everything, and now...
And now she has us, darling.
Uh-huh, you've taken her on.
Well, what option did we have? You should have seen the state she was in, poor creature.
I think Dr. Forgan might like to know.
It was astonishing. I was sitting here with the wireless on in this very room at about 9 that evening. Dennis was playing billiards on his own, and I was repairing his cycling breeches. It had been raining heavily all evening, and the fire was spitting and crackling. And then there was this thundering at the door, so loud and unexpected. The dogs created such a hullabaloo that they managed to disturb even Dennis's concentration. He hurried to the door, and there was Elaine, drenched and exhausted, and carrying a plastic bag. All her worldly goods in a plastic bag.
Well, how had she reached you?
By train, from Waterloo to Tisbury. Then from Tisbury, because she had no money left, she walked.
Walked through 7 miles of downpour.
if only she thought to telephone us.
She had no money.
She could have reversed the charges.
Anyway, here she was, obviously in difficulties and soaked to the skin.
I ran her a bath. Dennis made up a hot cordial. And I laid out some of Naomi's clothes.
And then the sorry tale was unfolded.
But there was worse to follow.
You overwhelmed her.
If she had no money...
It occurred to me, quite early on during her revelation, that of course she had no money. That her preposterous but helpful aunt had, as it were, subbed Elaine for 18 months through secretarial college. Given her pocket money, made her some kind of clothing allowance.
But all that must have stopped.
Immediately.
When Elaine chose to reject Miss Birmingham in favor of this girls' hostel in Richmond.
Where, presumably, the inmates would be allowed the merest modicum of pocket money.
Yes, of course. So, where did the train fare come from?
She stole it.
Borrowed it.
Stole it? If rifling someone's handbag and taking £10 without the owner's consent is borrowing, then by all means, Elaine borrowed her train fare. First-class fare, Dr. Forgan.
Yes, well, old habits die hard.
But she left a note saying she would repay the money.
And who repaid the money? Dennis?
The hostel had become intolerable, and she needed to get away. And she had neither the cash nor a checkbook, so she took the money and left an IOU.
The welfare officer, Miss Peel, actually took the trouble to motor down at the weekend, in her own time, all the way from Richmond, in a car that certainly had seen much better days. Dennis gave her the £10 immediately to repay this Mrs. somebody or other who was late from the hospital.
I liked Miss Peel.
She was a sensible young woman, and she took her duties seriously. She obviously liked Elaine. Elaine liked her. But made it clear she was never going back to London.
There were certain legal difficulties.
But Dennis, as an experienced solicitor, was able to shortcut most of them.
Because Elaine is still underage, someone must be legally responsible for her. First it was her aunt, then it was Richmond Council, and latterly, us. A neighbour of ours, Janet Bultitude, have you met her? Is a magistrate. With her approval and that of Miss Peel, Kate and I undertook to act as legal guardians to Elaine until she achieves her majority, which time, I might say, is imminent.
You're being very good to her.
We're very fond of her, Dr. Forgan. She's been a prisoner of her past, and we're determined to help her to escape to a better future.
And what will that future be?
Well, what was the future? And what about your silver?
The silver will have to wait.
Oh.
I offered Elaine a temporary sinecure. Well, there was something admirable about the Ludlams' determination to pull her fat out of the fire when I knew that they were hard-pressed financially. So I engaged Elaine at 10 bob an hour to catalogue my books.
But she guessed it was a handout.
I'm sure she did. Though both of us necessarily maintained the fiction that she was doing me an extraordinarily good turn. More?
Oh, please.
It was an uncomfortable period. Probably for her and certainly for me. I was planning a series of lectures, and I like solitude when I'm working. And suddenly, it was a human being in the place, in my life, for whom I had to assume some responsibility, giving her coffee, giving her tea, listening to her jejune ideas about life and art, taking her to the pub for lunch. Then, if she hadn't been round, I'd have improvised perfectly well.
Was she conscientious?
At times.
I found a jackdaw, Dr. Forgan.
She seemed to enjoy being amongst books, but she was easily distracted.
Can I give him some milk in the kitchen?
Anyway, the vacation came to an end, and the books were still in chaos, and Elaine went back to subsidise our employment with the Ludlams, and I went back to Oxford, imagining and hoping that I'd seen and heard the last of her.
But since there are several chapters to go...
I spent most of the Christmas vacation in India, where I ran into Blazer Povey in Madras.
Blazer?
Yeah. He was probably dodging debts in England. But he represented himself as manufacturing saddlery in India for consumption in the home counties.
Blazer was always versatile.
And then back home in the slow, cold slog of the Hillary term, I came back here shortly before Easter and set about ridding the place of dust, cobwebs and dry rot. I hadn't been here more than a couple of days when up cycled Dennis Ludlam. And I knew that tranquil days had gone again.
Ludlam appears to be your rural nemesis.
Young Elaine was the nemesis of us all. There'd been evidently a bizarre turn-up for the bookshade Ludlam, so would I join them for dinner? No talk of billiards this time. And talk it over. The dedicated bicyclist assured me in those profound and solemn tones that my advice would be particularly valuable since I was more than a passing acquaintance of the two involved parties.
seem to do nothing but cry on your shoulder, Dr. Forgan. But this time we're even more worried about Elaine.
What's she been up to this time?
She has eloped. With my brother.
Eloped?
Hardly the right word, old chap. Elaine and Richard have reached an understanding.
Look, can we job backwards a little? Richard is your brother, Mrs. London.
My youngest brother.
And is he married?
Not yet, thank heaven.
But he and Elaine have set up house together.
They're living together. In Marylebone.
And that distresses you?
It appalls me. Richard is 32, granted. But he's emotionally immature. And Elaine, well, you know Elaine, how insecure and highly strung she is.
But they're both of age, Mrs. Ludlam, and if this kind of life is what they want...
But it isn't what they want. It's an infatuation. If they should marry, they'll regret it for the rest of their lives.
Well, then the regret will be something they must live with.
That's exactly what Dennis said you'd say.
Because it's true. They are beyond our influence now.
They're nothing of the kind. They aren't married yet, are they?
What exactly are you wanting me to do? If you're expecting me to intervene in this love affair, then I'm accepting your hospitality under false pretenses. How can I help, indeed? Why should I help?
Because they're totally unsuited to one another and to marriage.
How could you possibly know that?
Because I know them both very well.
Look, I'm still in the dark. Mr. Ludlam intimated that I knew both people.
But you do. You know my brother, a pilot with Air Freight Cyprus, Richard Fricker.
Richard Fricker? So Elaine is...
Yes, that's who Elaine is.
Richard remembered you perfectly well when we discussed you.
Yes. Yes, I recall him. I've met him in company with other aircrew people, but what makes you feel so sure he's unsuited for marriage? If he's capable of flying an aeroplane satisfactorily, that makes him both practical and responsible.
He's been... Oh, what do they call it nowadays? He's been a loner too long. He's gauche in feminine society. I know he isn't ready for marriage now, and I doubt if he'll ever be ready for it.
These are sweeping statements, Kate.
Well, I remember your brother as being a pleasant young man, but shy, very shy. As to go...
The fact of the matter is that Elaine has turned his head.
Oh, now, darling.
She was lonely, because Naomi and the boys were all away. Richard decided to spend a week of his leave with us. Dennis naturally was at work all day, and I... Well, I always have more than enough to occupy myself with. So they were thrown together... unnaturally, and this ill-advised relationship began.
Look, I don't know your brother at all well, but I do know him, and to be fair, I think I can guess at your misgivings. That's understanding them. And that's interfering with his life. How can you, or your husband, or I, know what's gone on in the hearts of them both? If they're in love, and presumably they are, since they're living together in Marylebone, then why should anyone presume to interfere?
Because they're in no position to set up house together.
But an airline pilot makes a great deal of money. Well, more than I could ever hope to command.
I'm not talking about money. Surely you must realize that. Dennis, please, please, try to explain to Dr. Forgan.
The fact is that... Could we talk in the billiard room?
Oh, for heaven's sake, Dennis, we're all adults, aren't we?
Kate believes, and after all, she's known Richard all his life. Kate believes that he may be constitutionally unprepared for marriage.
Are you saying he's homosexual?
No.
Well, then what?
He has fewer urges than the mass of men. He doesn't need marriage. He's fallen in love with the idea of love. Yet to Elaine, he represents utter security and a happy ever-after conclusion. But that won't be the case.
Yeah, but isn't that something they'll have to discover or not for themselves? Aren't you taking too much responsibility on yourself? They may be ideally happy. Give them a chance.
Richard is my youngest brother. And I brought him up after my mother died, almost as if he were my son. I know him, Dr. Forgan. And we've known Elaine for 5 years, almost as a daughter. And we understand her. Of course we want what's best for them both. But what's best for them both is certainly not a marriage between them. It can only end in unhappiness.
Hello, Matthew.
Elaine.
Just about.
How long is it since... Look, come on in.
Can you give me a hand with the luggage?
So, when did we last meet?
In Limassol, at Arif's Magic Bar, 71. I was with Richard then.
And now?
Long story.
But you've arrived with luggage, so there's time.
Have you a cigarette?
Help yourself. Take the packet.
Thank you. You know, I didn't realize till we lived in Cyprus how many people you knew out there and how many people knew you.
Well, it's been my second home. When I was a boy, it was my first. My father worked out there.
I've heard all about that. But what about Neville Dimmock and Blazer Povey?
Oh, Blazer, back in Cyprus?
You can't keep away from the place, can you, the three of you?
Blazer, Neville and I were school friends. At the National Service, Blazer and Neville took short service flying commissions. By chance, they were posted to Akrotiri. I was sent out as an intelligence officer during the Aoka campaign because I spoke fluent Demotic Greek. Neville fell for the place just as I'd done. And since you've met him, you'll know about his business interests there.
Mm-hmm.
And your husband, too.
Went where his contract stipulated. Milk train run, Gatwick, Nicosia, Gatwick, freight.
Yeah. When I met you and Richard in Limassol, I must admit thinking the marriage was fraying a little around the edges.
Hmm.
And Ludlam said it would be disaster, you know. They wanted me to intervene.
You? What could you have done to stop it?
Well, that's exactly what I told them.
Yes, well, they were right, weren't they? But at the time, it seemed a good idea.
I gained the impression that you liked the life on Cyprus better than Richard did.
Oh, he never feels secure outside England.
But you clearly did.
We had a cottage in a village overlooking Kyrenia and the harbour. I've never known a more beautiful view in my life.
Nor have I.
Oh, yes, the magic's got to you. But it holds no charms for Richard. He wanted me to make the London flat my permanent base and fly out to Cyprus occasionally. I wasn't having any of that. Once I'd seen paradise, I wasn't going to settle for being there only 6 weeks a year. I had the cottage, I had a sports car, I had the sun and the grape and the olive. And I had friends. Some surprising friends, perhaps, but in that atmosphere you get a different perspective on things.
Morning.
I was wondering which of you is Clifford Arundel. Someone said he was here.
Did you say Clifford Arundel?
Yes, society and fashion photographer. They said he always wears a blazer.
Hello there. And a chap in Cyprus who always wears a blazer. The chap you're talking to. Blazer Perrier.
I see. They must have meant that you know Clifford Arundel.
Look, have we met?
Oh, yes, at Mr. Arundel's studio in Richmond.
Oh,
it was a long time ago, and you've obviously forgotten. But I haven't.
I think I can help you. Believe I know where old Cliff hangs out these days.
Ah. That's good. I have an urgent message for him.
Well, look, why don't we have a drink? Over there. We can talk about Cliff. Bit more privately. This charming young lady and I have a mutual friend who's in some kind of trouble.
Oh, of course.
Look, old love, I really don't remember you.
I was 17 at the time. You got me very drunk in your studio, and when I passed out, you stripped me and had your chums Ken and Mari perform. And you photographed what they were doing to me.
I did?
When I ran out of your studio, do you know what I did? I went home, I took a large bottle of aspirins and a bottle of sherry, and I went down to the river, and I tried to kill myself. What you'd done was the last filthy indignity in a year of indignities.
You mean it, don't you? You know, I do remember something. The deer in Richmond Park.
And your Hasselblad with all the fittings, yes.
Good Lord, good Lord. I'd no idea you'd react so strongly to a bit of fun.
Well, you must have been a little worried because you cleared out of that studio so fast that you forgot to pay the balance of the rent. What with that and your porno pictures and my go at suicide, the Richmond police still have an open file on Clifford Arundel.
You have no proof. Not now.
You're Edwin Blazer Povey, sometime flying officer, sometime con man, now engaged in a civilian capacity in public relations for the Ministry of Defence. And you're a year into a 3-year tour at Episcopi.
So?
All I have to do is go to the air officer commanding RAF Episcopi and tell him my tale. And I wonder how long it'll be before the Ministry of Defence hands you over to the Richmond police. I'd like an Ouzo, please.
You wouldn't do that, would you? I mean, it would do you no good at all. But it might dent my career, even though I'd certainly deny everything.
Why shouldn't I? You almost destroyed me.
If you were going to, you'd have been at Flagstaff House by now. You've done your homework, and I'm impressed. So why didn't you take it to the headmaster? Dear Ouzo, Paracolo.
It depends on what reparations you're prepared to make.
Now we're getting down to the nitty-gritty.
My husband is Richard Fricker. You know him.
Richie Fricker?
Yes.
Heard he was married. Didn't know who to. Congratulations.
Too late for those. He and I have come to the end of the line. He's going back to England to a permanent admin job. I want to stay out here. He's not prepared to maintain me out here. I have a cottage up the road and a sports car, and I live rather well. I don't want my standards to drop because my husband doesn't understand them.
So Blazer got his comeuppance.
Well done.
I thought he was a friend of yours.
Well, so he is, but you don't have to admire a person to like him, do you? Now, Blazer was always a bit of a scamp. I didn't think he'd actually stoop to pornography. But if it's any consolation, I'm sure he had no idea how horrifically you were going to react to his antics. There's no malice in the man.
That's true. I'm afraid he is likable. Oh, I had to drop my standards, of course. Blazer couldn't afford more than a 3-room flat and an old banger for me. But I didn't really mind. I mean, how much time do you actually spend inside a house there? The life's all outside, isn't it?
So Blazer did the right thing.
What was nice about Blazer was that he didn't whine, not once. He'd been caught red-handed, and he was prepared to pay up. We had some good times together. He was fun, and he knew fun people and fun places.
Yes, that's Blazer. Oh, did he ever mention his legacy?
That legacy! One day, me darling, when the old fruit pops off and me legacy comes through, we'll really paint the island red. In a strange kind of way, I suppose I should be grateful to him. If he hadn't nearly pushed me into suicide, I'd be a secretary in a ball-bearing factory in Twickenham.
But this odd idyll came to an end when the Turks invaded Cyprus.
Oh, of course. Blazer was really rather heroic. I'd intended to stay on in Kyrenia and damn the Turks. But when the shelling began, Blazer snatched me from the battle zone and drove me hell for leather to Akrotiri. He pulled rank and got me on the last seat of a trooping flight to Bryce Norton.
And from there?
I could hardly throw myself on the mercy of the Ludlums this time, could I? So it was Richard. Where else?
Did you expect me to be pleased to see you?
I hoped you might be.
Oh, for God's sake, Elaine. You've behaved selfishly and irresponsibly for 2 years. How did you expect me to feel when everyone in Cyprus knew you were Blazer Bloody Poby's kept woman? Have you thought what it was like for me at work? Pity or sniggers?
There was nothing to prevent you from finding some consolation yourself, was there?
I didn't want... I wasn't brought up to live like that, racketing around. I was brought up to stand to my guns. We're still married, aren't we? Supposed to be.
Do you want me back?
Would you have come back? Willingly, if the good life in Cyprus hadn't gone fut?
No.
Well, then.
Do you want a divorce?
I want a decent way of life with a wife I can trust. Is that unreasonable?
Oh, no, it isn't. Of course it isn't.
You look exhausted.
I am.
But what's to be done?
Richard, I don't know.
What's happened to Blazer, anyway?
His tour finishes next month.
And then what?
London, at the ministry.
I see. So, in fact, all you want is somewhere to lay your head free of charge till Blazer's open for business again in town.
No.
Well, I don't believe you.
Cyprus is over. Blazer was part of something I very much enjoyed out there. But Blazer in a bowler in pinstripes and a flat in Chorley Wood, no, not for me.
So I'm the court of last appeal, by default.
I'm very tired. I don't want to argue with you.
I don't want to argue either. But I think some kind of discussion's called for.
I've done the wrong thing again, and I'm sorry. I should never have come back here.
Would you be prepared to rearrange your priorities?
That sounds very technical.
No, let's not get smart. Look, I realise you don't want to live in London. But if there were somewhere, a really nice place in the country, would that appeal to you?
In the country?
A cottage. In a pretty village on the South Downs.
Another pipe dream?
No! I have a particular place in mind. Tudor, beamed, low ceilings, Inglenook, an acre of garden, and I can commute. With what I've saved, I'll only need a 25% mortgage. Honestly, Elaine, it's quite beautiful. Look. The estate agent's handout, and a photograph of the property.
Yes, it's lovely.
It is lovely. And you'd love the village. It really isn't the stockbroker belt. It's 50 minutes to London by rail. Far enough out to be rural.
And what would I do out there?
Oh, come on. Live a happy, normal life. Plenty of room for a dog and a cat. You could ride again. There's an excellent stables at the end of the village, and it's good hunting country.
And children.
What?
You'd want children.
Well, doesn't everyone?
Richard.
Yes?
Find another wife.
Well, what are you talking about?
Everything you've said sounds marvellous. For any girl but me.
But how can you know until you... Saturday. I'll drive you up there. We can see the house, have lunch, take a walk, you'll love it.
There's nothing the matter with your suggestion. There's nothing the matter with the place. I'm sure it's beautiful. There's nothing the matter with anything you've said. Except that it fills me with gloom and terror.
What the hell do you mean?
Are you sure you want to know?
Elaine!
All right. I would find it boring, boring, boring. I don't want to be a commuter's wife with two ideal children and two ideal pets in an ideal cottage in an ideal village, 50 ideal minutes from London. What would I do out there? And when you came home at 7:30 sharp and put on your slippers, what would we talk about? The golf club, the mother's union, gooseberry jam and flower arrangements and the vicar's little problems. How much the fees will be at Nigel's new school.
Oh, what a bitch. What a neurotic, selfish, dissatisfied bitch.
And I suppose I am to him. The story doesn't get any better, you know. I'm not a pre-Raphaelite heroine.
I never thought you were.
Oh, dear. Did you see through me from the beginning?
I don't know that I ever tried to. You were never uppermost in my thoughts.
How nice to find someone so disengaged.
It must be. So, what are you doing here?
I need a breathing space for a week or two.
Until Blazer comes back?
I suppose so.
Well, you know where the guest bedroom is. Dump your things there. You can stay till I say go, which won't be long.
Aren't you being rather hard on me, Matthew?
No harder than you've been on a number of people.
It's like that, is it?
Look, what have you been up to since you walked out on Richard?
Oh, travelling? Why?
Now, yesterday afternoon I received a telephone call from the Salisbury police. Oh, yes, I'm on the telephone now. Asking me, in effect, to give you a favourable character reference. An hour later, Dennis Ludlam was on the telephone. He'd had a similar request. So what's been going on?
I'm sorry. I didn't really expect them to check, you know. I thought it was a matter of form.
No, they checked. Why?
Well, when I left Richard, I decided to work my way west.
Towards the Ludlams, or me?
Oh, they were always reserve champions. I took a bus to Salisbury and decided to stay there for a few days. And before I realised it, I was out of cash.
Which had come from whom?
Richard gave me 50 quid. He felt it was cheap at the price to be rid of me. Anyway, I was out of makeup. And I wanted to look my best when I called on you. I went to a chemist's. Couldn't believe the prices of the makeup. And I seemed to have left without paying for what I took. Wasn't that forgetful?
But they were on to you.
It was only a matter of £9.58, a drop in the ocean.
Not to a local chemist.
Police, questions, statements, denials. It wasn't a bit amusing. And then the question of bail. Would you believe it? For £9.58, they wanted £75.
Which you hadn't got.
No. So, Mr. Plodd took me round to the hotel, and I managed to have 5 minutes' private conversation with the manager. He was very understanding. But on top of that, because I had no fixed abode, Mr. Plodd wanted references. I could hardly give Richard, so I'm afraid it was you and poor Dennis Ludlam.
When do you appear before the magistrate?
The day after tomorrow. Since I'm an itinerant, Mr. Plodd said he'd hurry me through, bless him. It's not very funny, is it?
It's stupid and rather shabby.
I knew I'd be in trouble.
Oh, Elaine. I've known you for what seems an eternity. I'm prepared to make a few allowances, but I draw the line now. If you'll guarantee to stay here until Thursday, I'll drive you over to Salisbury myself and try to put in a good word for you to the magistrates. Now, is that on?
I suppose it'll have to be.
All right. So take your things to the guest bedroom, have a bath, help yourself to drinks. I'll be back within an hour.
Where are you going?
I tend to keep an empty larder. It'll have to be replenished. You can cook us a Greek dinner tonight and we'll talk about Cyprus.
So the first store, you're in Philoxenia, sir?
I hope fully care on that kind of stuff.
Were you perhaps hoping for ultimate benefits?
From a down and out?
She's a very attractive bird.
It makes a difference when you've known them since they came in wearing wet jodhpurs and a torn hairnet after a gymkhana.
Does it? I fancy they're like hell, you know. And when I heard about her arrangement with Blazer, I was very jealous. Oh, this was after Audrey's death, of course.
You saw her. You saw them regularly.
Oh, not regularly, but quite often. Tiny's club. Famagusta, mainly. Sometimes Blazer'd be after a Nordic blonde or a shady deal, and I'd be left very happily with Elaine. She could take her liquor, could that girl?
She could take a lot of things, now you come to mention it. Any rate, after our up-and-downer, I motored to Tisbury and bought all the makings for the Greek blowout from the delicatessen there. Then I called on Theo Edwardis.
Theo, it's settled down at last.
In a very pretty manor house. I'll take you there tomorrow. Anyway, I got some ouzo and retsina from Theo's private stock and came back here. First thing I saw was her note.
Aye, aye.
And I had a presentiment of ill luck.
Dear Matthew, I'm sorry about all this. I hope you'll understand someday. Much love, Elaine.
I was put out, of course, but not extravagantly so. I began to think how lucky I was not to be landed with such a spectacularly unfortunate girl. Though I'd quite look forward to a dinner for two, but a dinner for one twice would be perfectly agreeable. Then I went into the dining room.
I've been waiting for this. How I've been waiting for this.
It took me some time to realize what was strange about the place. Then I looked again at the sideboard and the dining table, and I knew.
Elaine pinched your silver.
The mustache sounds so jocular. I was furious, angry, hurt and bewildered to betray me like this.
Did you report the theft?
No.
There you go. Now, soft.
Well, would you have reported it, given her circumstances?
Of course I would. Well, I don't know. I really don't know.
Oh, I raged around. I swore vengeance. I was on the point of calling the police a half a dozen times. But in the end, I didn't.
It's obvious. You always had a soft spot for the girl.
Well, that may be true. I'm not sure. But what I became sure of was the absence of value of things like silver ornaments. Yes, they were mine and she'd stolen them, but they were not articles I'd longed for and paid for myself. They were heirlooms. Things that had been around the family since I don't know when, but not specific to me. Now, if she'd stolen my notes and my manuscripts, then yes, Interpol on the instant. But table decorations, as against a bruised and difficult life. Had I named her the theft, together with her shoplifting and the jumping of bail, she'd have done time. No question of it. And I wasn't going to be responsible for that.
So instead she got away with it, scot-free.
Well, I was still angry at her betrayal of trust, but well, this was a private thing. I wanted to know what use she could make of the silver and why.
She's a sly boot, she really is. She admitted absolutely nothing in that dear John note she left you.
Well, I imagine she'd had enough of lawyers after her father's disaster to be wary of putting anything significant down on paper.
You're still making feeble excuses for criminal behaviour.
Oh, all right, yes, why not? I haven't suffered as she suffered.
So suffering's a sufficient excuse for larceny.
Well, Neville, you've met the girl. You've confessed to an admiration for her. You know what she's like. Now, would you have put a spoke in her wheel?
You're going to tell me next you never slept with her.
I didn't.
But I did. Look, in Blazer's time, she was the town bicycle of Kyrenia.
I don't believe it.
Suit yourself. Anyone who could buy her a few drinks and share a good time and... way-hey!
Well, this is locker room braggadocio, and I don't believe it. She may have been desperate, but she was never promiscuous.
All right, suit yourself.
Oh, do shut up! Now, we've been friends for 30 years. There's no need to lie to me. I'll accept that Elaine's a thief, a chancer, a failed suicide, and a homewrecker. What I'm not prepared to accept is that she's a whore.
You keep going your way, and I keep going my way.
What kind of answer is that?
I mean it, Matt. You're on dangerous ground. You look on that girl as a daughter and a mistress. That can't be healthy.
You're deliberately misreading the relationship.
Oh, no, I'm not. What I want is clarification, and that's something you're just evading.
I'm not evading anything. I haven't reached the final chapter yet.
Oh, I see. I'm all ears.
Right, then. About 4 years after the incident of the stolen silver, it would be a Saturday in Trinity, and I was still in residence. I drove out to Woodstock. An auction of the contents of some old family home had been advertised. I'd bought a catalogue and found a couple of things I was interested in. The auction took place in what must have been the drawing room. It was large and it was packed. I suppose most of the people there were dealers, but there were a few obvious punters like me. Now, what I was really after was a bust of Jonathan Swift.
Bit out of your bailiwick, isn't he?
I'll call it impulse. Anyway, the bidding began, and after a short time, there were only two people left in the running, myself, and a woman I was unable to see because of the crush in the room and all the furniture. Now, she took me far past what I'd originally set as my limit, and then she dropped out. The bust was mine. Shortly afterwards, when most of the good lots had gone, quite a few people left, and I was able to see my erstwhile competitor. It was Elaine.
You could knock me down with a feather.
Well, I collared her outside in the drive. She was neither flustered nor embarrassed. She was looking rather beautiful and very composed. She said that the meeting called for a celebration, would you believe it? She was staying at the Bear in Woodstock, and would I meet her there for dinner?
You didn't fall for that one.
Well, I wanted some assurance that she'd turn up. She smiled, a little wryly, and told me she could hardly blame me. Then she took off her wrist a very expensive and beautifully designed antique gold bracelet. There, Matthew, she said. If I'm not in the bar by 7:30, you can keep that.
Didn't I say she was sly?
But would she be there?
Was it really antique and gold and very expensive?
I'm a scholar, Neville. I like to get the facts right.
Then she was there.
She was there, and she'd arranged things with style. A bottle of good champagne waiting for us on ice in a discreet corner of the room.
Well, Matthew, it's lovely to see you again.
You sure?
Oh, you're my oldest friend.
What about the Ludlams?
My oldest adult friend.
Oh, you're back on form again.
Things have been much worse.
Yes. Where is the life that late I led, say they? Why, here it is. Welcome these pleasant days.
One of the ancient Greeks?
No, the ancient pistol.
You always were too clever for me.
Rubbish. I like your choice of champagne. Now, what's become of my silver? And if you say you're glad I asked you that, I'll knock your head off.
I was desperate when I took it.
Oh, yeah?
I'd had everything once, and we lost it when Daddy crashed. I thought I had everything again in Cyprus until the invasion. Then I lost out a second time. It's not very funny to lose everything twice within 8 years.
Well, I realize that, being your oldest adult friend. Otherwise, the police would have been on your back double quick. But why didn't you ask me for help? I didn't give you money.
It's too ashamed to ask for money.
But not too ashamed to steal from a friend. What kind of chopped logic's that?
You don't think logically when you're in the mess I was in.
You knew that I cared for you. Or at least cared about you.
But you've never wanted me, have you?
Well, how do you know?
Things like that, you just know.
I see.
If you'd wanted me, instead of regarding me as a tiresome social interlude, then I'd have asked, anything.
Oh, you would.
I know nature's bachelors when I see them. You're one. And I realized too late that Richard was another.
You presume a great deal more knowledge of the world than your experience gives you any right to.
You could never stand the disorderliness of a male-female relationship. You've had life on your own terms all your life. And anyway, I'm too young for you, and I always would be. And you know what I mean by young.
Well, I can see you're having a heyday with some fantasy of your own. And I still want to know about my silver.
Matthew. If I'd accepted money from you and the nice Greek dinner, you'd have insisted on my going through with the magistrate's trial, and everything about me would have come out. I couldn't stand the idea of that. A nice, dishonest blazer would have been far more welcome. I'm sorry. I went back to London. Where else could I go? Richard, poor love, very generously gave me a small allowance. I took a tiny flat in Pimlico. Eventually, by all kinds of jiggery-pokery that you'd rather not hear, I managed to get a stall in Petticoat Lane.
with my centerpiece of silver to dazzle the customer.
It did make me look very upmarket. But I didn't sell the pieces, not for ages. And when I did, the proceeds went to a sharp solicitor who managed to extract a once-for-all cash settlement from Richard in return for a tidy divorce. With that, I began to build up my business. Then Blazer turned up.
Absolutely on cue. Matthew, old lad, it's been too long between drinks.
Blazer, for heaven's sake.
What, chap allowed some of the celebration bubbles?
Yes, allow me.
Cheers. Well, Matt, don't you agree? My wife looks absolutely radiant.
Your wife? Well, we hadn't got as far as that. When did all this happen?
After the legacy.
Is there any more to legacy?
You chaps would never take it seriously, would you?
Well, can you blame it?
Actually, no. There it was. Larger than even I could have expected. Enough to set up yours truly and the little lady on relatively easy street.
This beats the band, it really does.
Doesn't it, though? So now Elaine has her camp little business in Wigmore Street, and young Blazer's at last indulging his lifelong interest in politics.
Politics? Oh, Blazer, you've gone right over the top.
You don't understand. Blazer can be very persistent once he puts his mind to it. He's been offered a very safe seat in a North London constituency, and you should see him with his party workers. I can't entirely believe it myself.
What party would that be, Blazer?
Oh, Labour every time, all that. Didn't you spot the red tie?
You have been adopted by the Labour Party as official candidate? Labour?
Well, of course. I've been down and out, Matt. I've seen life at the bottom and from the bottom. Well, she meant the local agent was more than appreciative when I socked him with a substantial contribution to public others. Here was a chap prepared to back what he believed.
Oh, my God.
And I'll tell you this, old squire. If I'm not in Westminster after the next election, I'll give all I have to the poor. Apart from our parent in Barbados.
Hmm. So you're sitting pretty. I'm delighted.
That tone of voice means the exact opposite.
Well, I was wondering how much the sale of my silver realized. And why neither of you saw fit post-legacy to reimburse me for my involuntary contribution to the Povey Fund.
Do you know, lad, it simply slipped our memories. Good Lord, of course you must have reimbursement.
But the silver gone forever.
I'm afraid so.
Oh, never mind. I hope the lucky owner's deriving the same pleasure from it that the Forgans did for 5 or 6 generations.
You've taken this jolly sport, old man. But I must insist on giving you a check.
No, I have a much better idea. I have in my possession an extremely valuable gold bracelet, which I'm sure was worth a good deal to you.
Yes, I was just going to ask for it.
And I promise you this.
Thanks.
If Blazer does succeed in topping the poll, we'll both have the satisfaction of knowing that I'll be celebrating his victory by selling the bracelet and giving all the proceeds to the poor.
They really are an extraordinary couple of people. But do you believe this marriage will last?
Oh, I think so. They suit each other perfectly. Blazer was always immoral, and Elaine's early misadventures have made her amoral. They not only suit each other, they deserve each other.
What I can't get over is Blazer embracing the Labour cause. Of all the cynical self-seeking...
Well, as we both know all too well, when Blazer sets his mind to a caper, he's very thorough about it. Now he has money, he's looking for power. Oh, I'm sure he doesn't give a damn which political party he hitches his wagon to. He's capable of crossing the floor 12 times with all the charm in the world and of getting away with it.
Hmm. Well, now you've run them to earth, will you make any attempt to keep up with them?
Well, there'll be no need for that. Because I'm certain our paths are too crossed by now to separate completely. In 2 years or 5, there'll be a telephone call or a knock at the door, and I'll be into a whole new imbroglio.
Oh, really? I'd have thought you'd be glad to wash your hands of them.
Well, as a matter of fact, I find it all rather refreshing. I lead a pretty sedentary life. Oh, shall. Shielded, indeed, from virtually everything I dislike or find tedious. People like us sit on the sidelines and we watch the varying fortunes of the players. Then something happens to connect us with the players. A ball within our reach. Smile across the grass. And we're involved. There's no escaping that involvement. We're dragged in on the game, for better or worse.
In Elaine's game, certainly for worse.
Oh, yes. You see, that day outside the auction, what really angered me was Elaine's twofold insolence. The first, that despite falling on her financial feet, she made no attempt to repay me for the silver she pinched. And second, that gesture of handing me something enormously expensive just to prove she was in the money and to indicate, I'm certain, that she knew her good old reliable Dobbin Forgan was not a man to levant with her property. So, I wanted to give her something to think about every time she dresses. But there's a missing piece from her private collection. And there it is. Pretty little bauble, isn't it?
It's magnificent. Must be worth a fortune. Are you really going to keep it?
I shall carry out my promise. If Blazer becomes a member of Parliament, that bracelet will be sold and the proceeds will go to a sound charity.
But if he fails to get the seat?
Well, then, I shall give the proceeds to the Conservative Party. In Blazer's name, of course.
In Welcome These Pleasant Days by Michael Robson, Elizabeth Proud played Elaine, Nigel Anthony, Forgan, and Ian Hogg, Dimmock. Dennis Ludlam was John Westbrook, Kate, Peggy Ann Wood, Wilfred Birmingham, Peter Woodthorpe, and Angela Birmingham, Constance Chapman. Blazer Povey was Norman Bowler, Daphne, Joe Anderson, Susan, Angela Phillips, and Richard, Cornelius Garrett. Welcome These Pleasant Days was directed from Bristol by Sean McLaughlin.
That play can be heard again on Monday afternoon, just after 3. Our play tomorrow afternoon is a love story set in the glamorous world of high society after the end of the First World War. It's a dramatization of Michael Arlen's novel, Piracy. That's tomorrow at 2:30. In a quarter of an hour at 10:15, the life and poetry of Thomas Hood is the subject of Breast High Amid the Corn. Now the weather forecast for tomorrow. Scotland will have outbreaks of rain or drizzle, although some northern parts will be dry at first. England, Wales and Northern Ireland will be rather cloudy, although a few bright or sunny intervals are expected. Many places will be dry, but some rain is likely in northern and eastern counties of England in the morning. It will be very mild, though rather cold at first in northern Scotland. And the outlook for Monday and Tuesday, staying mild. Some rain or drizzle in the north and west, but mostly dry in central and eastern England. And that's the weather. Radio 4.
BBC News at 10 o'clock. This is Pauline Bushnell. Some of the martial law restrictions in Poland are being lifted. Warsaw Radio has announced that it will be easier to hold public gatherings and to make telephone calls within Poland. There have been demonstrations in many countries in support of the people of Poland. The Russians say the woman hunger striker moved to hospital from the American embassy in Moscow has been taking food. Stanley Holloway, comedian, character actor and master of the monologue, has died. Workers at the DeLorean car factory in Northern Ireland have been given details of the company's redundancy plans. The authorities in Poland said tonight that they were lifting some of the martial law regulations imposed 7 weeks ago. According to Warsaw Radio, restrictions on public gatherings, including entertainment and sporting events, are to be reduced, and communications within the country will become easier. For example, internal telephone links will be restored temporarily from February the 10th, though conversations will be monitored. Some regional newspapers and radio stations will be allowed to operate again. Here's Frank Smith of our Foreign News Star.
Although the more draconian measures introduced under martial law will remain in force, the fact that some restrictions are to be lifted can be taken as a carrot dangled by the authorities in front of the Polish people. But with the carrot, there's also the stick. Telephone communication is to be temporarily restored between all towns in the country. But these calls will be through the operator and will be monitored. The inference is that the restoration will depend on the result of the monitoring. Telegrams will also be accepted, but will continue to be subject to censorship. The easing of these restrictions, as Warsaw Radio puts it, relates to the private lives of Poles. Among other things, people will now be able to get married and hold family gatherings without obtaining permission from the authorities. Also, meetings called by parish elders will no longer require permits, but other gatherings, such as general meetings, conferences, lectures, demonstrations and marches, will still have to be authorized. They will, in other words, remain banned.
Rallies and marches have been staged in many countries to show support for the people of Poland and for the independent trade union Solidarity, outlawed under the martial law regulations. In the United States, there have been demonstrations in a dozen cities. The Secretary of State, Mr. Alexander Haig, is due to speak at a rally in Chicago tonight, where there's a large Polish community. There have been demonstrations, too, in Canada and Australia, and in Tokyo, Vienna and Brussels. There were more than 100 rallies and marches in West Germany, where Chancellor Schmidt, in a telegram to the Trade Union Federation, repeated the government's demand for an end to martial law in Poland. In Britain, a Solidarity representative who left Poland last year addressed a rally of 3,000 people in Nottingham, while in London, several hundred supporters of the Polish Solidarity campaign marched to the Polish embassy to keep a candlelight vigil. Earlier, they'd heard speeches by MPs, trade union officials, and leaders of the Polish community in Britain calling for an end to martial law. One of the speakers, the Labour MP and Shadow Minister Mr. Peter Shaw, suggested that Britain and other Western countries should impose trade sanctions to try to get the restrictions lifted, a point he elaborated on later.
Quite obviously. The fact that not only Poland but the Soviet Union is dependent on the West for a great number of things, including the purchase of essential food supplies, the purchase of technology, the purchase of goods of all kinds, that gives the West a bargaining position and a position of leverage, which, if it's used intelligently, may help to bring about many of the results that we want.
Mr. Peter Shaw. The Soviet press has again attacked the United States government over its support for the television spectacular on Poland to be broadcast tomorrow. TASS, the official news agency, describing President Reagan as a former actor, said he had decided to stage cheap shows in Hollywood's best tradition, that is, boisterous and vociferous spectaculars with as little meaning as possible.